Father in the heavens, I appeal to you through Yahshua the Messiah. Please now empower us all to participate in this exploration of the riches of your word. We acknowledge how your plan has been laid out through the Hebrew race, the Israelite nation. We appeal to you, Father, to let every foolish thing I might say fall to the ground. Everything that's edifying and true, cause it, Father, to go deep and take root and bear forth fruit in our lives. Committing this meeting into your hands with many thanks, we pray. Amen. Boy, oh boy, there's a phrase in the Psalms that mentions the beauty of holiness. I feel so privileged to participate in these meetings. The music has been so excellent. Hebrew roots, the real thing. Brothers and sisters, I'm Brother Michael Bannock from Fulton, Missouri, a suburb of Holt Summit. The title of my remarks today is Hebrew Roots, the Real Thing. Hallelujah. I've gotten victory over an infection that's been banging on the door, but I'm still a little scratchy in my throat. I wonder if there might, I don't want to turn y'all into my gophers, but I wonder if there's a fresh bottle of water around or somebody could get a cup of water just in case. I'm so sorry to trouble you with that. Look, it even opens it for me. Don't maybe you'd like to drink it too? Hebrew roots, the real thing. My concern is that some of you may think Hebrew roots is the only thing. And I find myself torn because while the Hebrew roots approach to the faith is very intellectually satisfying, it's spiritually edifying, not all parts of it are for everybody. If I ever sense that, I don't see this happening, but if I ever sense that YRM was requiring everybody to know Hebrew to really understand the Bible, I'd say there's something very wrong there. But in fact, as you make your way through the Hebrew roots movement in the United States, it seems all they do is talk about academic stuff. If you go to a Hebrew roots conference, often they go into these death spirals, just talking about mystical things. What do the letters mean? Adding up numbers and stuff about the Hebrew culture, which is so irrelevant to us. It seems like they're just going off on bunny trails. And where, again, it's intellectually satisfying, it isn't very spiritually edifying. The Hebrew roots approach to the faith provides unique insights to the scriptures. Hebrew roots is a label applied to many things, such as the Sabbath and the Holy Name. Yet those things are not uniquely Hebrew. For example, the Sabbath was instituted at the dawn of man, dawn of creation. That's not a Hebrew. But if you'll hear a talk on Hebrew roots, you might hear them put a lot of time into talking about the Sabbath. The Sabbath is universal. There's nothing particularly Hebrew about that. Let's talk about the Holy Name. Yes, the Holy Name is Hebrew, but that is also very ancient. First time you hear it in the scriptures is Eve has a baby. She says, I have begotten a man, Yahweh. And we don't know if that means from Yahweh or if she thought that was the Messiah that she was told was coming. Because the Yahweh means he who will be or he who is coming. So, boy, that name, the holy name, my goodness, what a delicious study that is in itself. When the Almighty explained his name to Moses, he uses the current normal verb to be, haya, ehya, esher, ehya, I am that I am. Common average verb to be. It occurs about 3,500 times in the Hebrew text. Haya, it's used in phrases like, it shall come to pass, it shall be, he will do this, he will do that. It's an ordinary verb to be. So he explains his name with ordinary Hebrew, haya. He puts an aleph in front of it, ahya, esher ahya. I am that I am, or I will be what I will be. But then when he gives him the name, he takes an ancient verb to be, hawa. A very ancient, very rare verb to be. I looked it up. It only occurs 6 times in the Hebrew text in ordinary sentences. We'll see one of those in a little while. It's a rare and ancient verb to be. He sticks a yod in front of it to mean hey, he. So it becomes he is or he will be. One of the reasons I'm so keen on transliteration. Oh, you're making you nervous there, huh? Thank you. Oh, I see. Well, one of the reasons I'm so keen on transliteration is, you think about it, if Yahweh was to just translate his name into modern Hebrew for Moses, he would have made his name Yah Yah. I know that sounds kind of cool because it sounds like Yah, but when he uses this ancient form of the verb to be that's telling us, he wants us to carefully transliterate that through the ages. But I don't believe a holy name is uniquely Hebrew. I think it's an extremely ancient name that existed long before Eber, the ancestor of the Hebrews, came along. Hebrew roots is also a label applied to many practices, prayer shawls, Jewish traditions, personal accessories with Hebrew letters on them, Jewish mysticism and Kabbalah. I see no problem with prayer shawls. There are some Jewish traditions that are absolutely beautiful. I think it's cool to have personal accessories with Hebrew letters on them. Nothing wrong with those three things. But I don't think that's the core of Hebrew roots. Now, Jewish mysticism and Kabbalah, I have no use for that. And I hope we never slip into that. Because it feels good. It's just very intellectually satisfying. Your mind goes into a fog and you start thinking about symbols and numbers and things, and it doesn't lead to righteousness. It doesn't heal broken families. Even though the first three things, there's nothing wrong with them, the fourth one, Jewish mysticism, is Kabbalah, but none of these things are in the Bible. So when I talk about Hebrew roots, I'm talking about going back to the Bible stuff. Our approach today will emphasize those things uniquely derived from the Hebrew scriptures and Hebrew culture. And even when it comes to Hebrew culture, we have to be careful. Just because something is in Hebrew culture, that doesn't mean it's right. We will take a look at specific applications of the Hebrew roots approach to the faith. We'll assess the benefits and the risks of these things. Now, let me add one more point. I put a lot of time and preparation into the closing material. About a third of our time, we're going to look at a Hebrew roots approach to the faith that doesn't require you to know Hebrew or to buy blankets with Hebrew letters on them or anything like that. It's a way that you can immediately apply. You can actually apply it daily. If you look at Hebrew roots the way the Bible presents it to us, and it's going to just jump out of the pages at you. It's something we can all get into. It's something we can all get excited about. At the same time, we can still enjoy our coffee mugs with the word shalom on it and, you know, things like that. Okay, I'm going to take a drink. Hold on, please. I want to thank my brother Wilson Wongi for his assistance. I want to thank my brother Javon Love for some very fruitful conversations about this, and other friends who've helped me put this together. Several applications of the Hebrew roots approach to the faith. One of them is to study the meanings of words themselves. Here we use Hebrew lexicons and dictionaries. Now, a lexicon is more than a dictionary. Lexicon gives you information about etymology, that is, where a word comes from, derivation information. Also, a good lexicon will give you notes on similar words in related languages. A good lexicon is very intense. It's sometimes hard to read. They'll also have mention made of how that word is translated into other languages. Let's get something straight. There are times when I might say, I went to the Hebrew dictionary or I went to the Hebrew lexicon, but don't think I went right to the Hebrew. There's no such thing as going right to the Hebrew. The guys who put those lexicons together have studied tons of other languages, related languages, unrelated languages. there's about a fourth of the words in the Bible. We're still not certain what those words mean. We look to related languages or cognate languages or other dialects of Hebrew to help fill in those gaps. A lexicon is a real high-power tool, but there are some high-end dictionaries that will bear a resemblance to a lexicon. Here's a picture of some of the most popular ones in the movement. On the far left is Jacinius' Hebrew Chaldee lexicon on the Old Testament. Now, Chaldee and Aramaic, Babylonian, same language. There's portions of the Old Testament that are Aramaic, with Yahweh's name in those passages. Then there's the Brown Driver Briggs lexicon, which is in the middle. What you have is two photographs kind of spliced together there. One shows the bookend with the Aleph and Tau. Then there's what the front looks like. And I happen to own those two versions of Jacinius and the Brown Driver Briggs. Well, Brown Driver Briggs just took Jacinius's work and applied more information. So both of these works are derived from the work of Wilhelm Jacinius, who was a German Hebraicist. Oh, I forget, like in the early 1800s maybe. But since then, we've found inscriptions and archaeological finds and writings and documents, all kinds of things that fill in the gaps, stuff that these guys didn't know. If I had time, I could give you examples of how our translations have been impacted by discoveries such as the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Ugaritic Hebrew settlement in the western part of the Holy Land. Today's lexicons are just huge. This one is a dictionary of classical Hebrew, a modern one. It comes in 8 volumes. Who has time for all that? You know, I'm right now engaged in a very in-depth study of Hebrew linguistics. And when this thing's over with, I want to throw the books out. Because I want to get back to the knowing my Father in heaven the old-fashioned way. Listen, I didn't put this in the notes, but when I worked at AT&T Bell Labs back east, with the microchip facility, there was just a small number of people in what they call the clean room, surrounded by glass, and they had to wear white bunny suits, and the floor was sticky, so there was not a lot of dust around. But it was a small number of people. But the way Western Electric and Bell Labs were structured, you had multiple layers of management. So what you had was this top-heavy thing where dozens of people were watching what a small number of people were doing. The real action was in the clean room where they were making the chips. That's where the action was. Everybody else kind of had their face pressed up against the glass. And that's what this stuff looks like to me sometimes. All these scholars running around with their Hebrew words and their Hebrew letters. But the real action is the characters in the Bible. Those who got on their knees and made contact with heaven. And things started happening, big things. And so there's a sense of dryness that comes with this. Yeah, it's intellectually satisfying. But there's a sense of dryness that comes over time. Am I really getting to know Yahweh with all this? Do you think Abraham and Sarah sat down on a quiet afternoon and aligned the Hebrew letters to see if it would make a Star of David? Do you think they did that kind of thing? But that's what you'll see if you go to a Hebrew Roots conference. People go, ooh, that's cool, you know. And those of you who know me well know a strong doctrinal foundation means a lot to me, but there comes a point where you got to live it out. Few things are more pathetic than a man or woman who knows Hebrew but doesn't know how to talk to their spouse. Few things are more pathetic than that. Study applications, the meanings of words themselves. Now, when we use lexicons today, we like to use Strong's numbers, concordance numbers, to identify the words. people who are real good at Hebrew, they don't need that stuff. But a guy like me needs the numbers that James Strong applied to each of the Hebrew words. And it's a great tool because if you buy modern versions of the Jacinius and the Brown Driver Briggs, they have Strong's numbers in the column to help you locate the word. Jacinius put them in kind of alphabetical order, kind of like Strong's did, but Brown Driver Briggs put it in the, they sorted it by root word, so it's harder to find words there. But those numbers help a whole lot. I'm going to give you an example. Let's take the Hebrew word yom, meaning day. Hebrew 31:17 is in Yom Kippur, day of covering or day of atonement. Yod Vav Mem. Yod Vav Mem. It's in the lower left-hand corner. Yom. Now, it's good to know when somebody says, oh, it's Yom Kippur. Well, it's good to know what yom means, day. Is it possible to go too deep into this stuff? Now, there's risks in this. Critics have found that when you go too deep into these lexicons and you find the origin, the root, basic, fundamental origin of a word, you wind up missing the truth. You think you're getting the truth, but you're kind of missing it. Because by the time that word has embedded itself in the Hebrew language and culture, its meaning has changed such that the original root doesn't have a whole lot of information there. I'll give you an example in English. I'm an engineer, but I don't have anything to do with engines. You know? And I do microchips, you know? It's one of those things. Steve, you're an engineer. Do you work with engines? Do you go to work with an oily rag dangling out of your hat, a pocket? What? But this is a problem you'll find when you start drilling deeper and deeper into Greek and Hebrew. You'll find that the root words, after a while, they're related to what you're studying, but only in sort of a remote sense. Now, I'll give you an example. I hope these letters aren't too small for you. The fundamental meaning of the root word yom means to be hot. Does this mean it only refers to sunlight times? Well, if I'm talking about day and night, yeah, yom, and I think the word night might be yerev. I could be wrong. But anyway, does that mean yom cannot include a nighttime cycle? Genesis 1:5, and Elohim called the light day, yom, and the darkness he called night. And the evening and morning were the first day. Some people have sought to make an issue of this. You'll find people go back to the root meaning of a word, and they blow it up, they fill up the page with this, and they try to make some doctrinal stand out of it. Some have sought to claim that Yom cannot include the night. In Joshua 1:11, there's many verses like this. I just picked one. In Joshua 1:11, it says, pass through the host and command the people, saying, prepare your victuals, for within 3 days, yom or yomim for plural, you shall pass over this Jordan to go in to possess the land which Yahweh your Elohim giveth you to possess it. Now, this obviously includes some nighttime periods. You suppose there was no nightfall for those 3 days? Just because it said yom? It doesn't always say 3 days and three nights. Sometimes it just says 3 days, and you know there's going to be some night times in between. I hate to say this, friends, but it is possible to go off the deep end and come with some very narrow definitions of the words. And before you know it, people are arguing. Let's see, okay. People are arguing over stuff they really don't understand. In fact, I'm convinced so many of the arguments that people are engaging in today, when they go too deep, I think the ancients, if they were to drop in on us, they'd laugh at us. We never meant that. We never had that in mind. Hebrew dictionaries and lexicons are to be used with care. One phenomenon we see with one destructive cult in the Southwest is the guy came up with a translation of the Bible that tortures every verse. And the definitions he got from the Bible are way down deep, like a word will have 8 definitions and he'll pick number 7 or number 8. Naomi's looking at me. She knows what group I'm talking about. Some of these guys are bad. They pick the most weird way to interpret a word to twist and torture a new doctrine. Most dictionaries are disappointing in their depth. Lexicons are also scholarly grade dictionary carries the day. We got to be careful. Our Jewish friends should not be expected to support messianic principles. Even our messianic Jewish brethren can inject errors based on tradition. Got to be careful with these things. Let's look at a cultural application. Well, you know something about Hebrew culture, that it causes the scriptures to come into sharper contrast, sharper view. In 2 Corinthians 11:24, Paul says, "Of the Jews, five times I received 40 stripes, save one." Okay. In other words, he got 39 stripes, 39 whips across his back. Why only 39 stripes? Or maybe if alternately, why that many? But, I mean, that seems like a strange number. Was that 3 times 13? Was there some mystical reason why they did that? Well, in Deuteronomy 25:3, the Torah says, 40 stripes he may give him and not exceed, lest if he should exceed and beat him above these with many stripes, then thy brother should seem vile unto thee. Remember, in Yahweh's economy, the objective is to redeem people. You see that word for restitution in the Torah. It's talking about shalom, wholeness. When somebody does something naughty, you want to get them back. You don't want to crush them or destroy them unless it's a capital punishment, a capital crime. But if somebody does something worthy of stripes, you don't want to crush the guy and you don't want to make him vile in your eyes. It's possible for the punishing agent to get carried away and lose respect for the guy. Yahweh says, there's no reason to go beyond 40. Well, in Jewish custom, they go to 39 and they stop there. Why? Because in case they lost count, they don't want to exceed 40. So they dial in a one-stroke margin. They say, we'll stop at 39 so we don't go to 40. So in 2 Corinthians 11:24, we're getting a snapshot of two things. We're getting a snapshot of the Torah, where you're limited to 40 stripes. You're getting a snapshot of Jewish application. They said, let's make it 39 just to be safe. This would be like if the speed limit says 55 and you went 54. You punch that in your cruise control. You know I'm on the safe side. Now, the 39-stripe limitation is not in the Hebrew Bible. It was part of Jewish culture and also shows that Paul received the maximum possible whipping they could allow with the Hebrew scriptures in view. So he got 39 stripes because they couldn't give him any more. They really hated this guy. Five times to be whipped with that many whippings. That must have been horrible. There must have been like bloody spots on the back of his garment sometimes. Some of us had trouble getting to the feast. I mean, this guy was beaten so bad and he had been shipwrecked. Some of us had a hard time getting to the feast. It's tempting to whine, friends, but I don't think that's a good idea in light of this. I mislabeled the top of this slide, but here's another example of Hebrew culture. Again, this isn't something necessarily in the Bible, but when I read scholarly works about this stuff, they give me the impression they're talking about something peculiar to the Hebrew language. I'm going to read Matthew 23:8-9. "But be not called ye rabbi, for one is your rabbi, even the Messiah, and all of you are brethren." "And call no man your father upon the earth, for one is your father which is in heaven." Now, according to the way Hebrew thought unfolds, like the poetry in Proverbs, you have these two statements, and you can swap certain parts of it, and it'll still be true. So I highlighted the part, "Be ye not called rabbi, and call no man your father." And I just exchanged those in the two verses. Now, you can only do this if the exchange supports the sense of Scripture. You can't do this exchange and then say, okay, I got a new doctrine now. You're not supposed to do that. But it stands to reason, if I cannot call a man rabbi, pardon, if I cannot allow you to call me rabbi, you are not allowed to call me rabbi. It makes sense that if I am not allowed to call you father, I shouldn't let you call me father. It stands to reason. But that's a symmetry that you'll see, especially in the book of Proverbs. A lot of times you'll see a verse in Proverbs where you can exchange the nouns in the two sentences and exchange them. It still stands. And as long as it doesn't torture the intent of the verse, that is permissible in Hebrew thought. In Hebrew poetry, the thoughts rhyme. The words may not rhyme, but the thoughts sure rhyme. Let's see. Now this clicker here is the space command. Sometimes jumps around. Okay. Here are the risks of taking knowledge of Hebrew and biblical culture into account. The mere existence of something in Hebrew culture does not make it holy or just. I always get on edge when somebody says, this is a Hebrew concept, and I think, okay, where did they get this from? How did they prove this? I'll give you an example. It was not in the notes. I thought of it driving over here today. Jacob made a deal with Laban, his crooked father-in-law. He said, hey, as the cattle are produced, I'll just take the spotted ones. Okay? I'll just take the spotted ones. And Laban says, good deal. And then Jacob and his wife, I may get some details wrong, but they put rods that were spotted in the eyes, in the viewing, you know, the field of vision for the animals while they're feeding. And while they're feeding, they're looking at these spotted rods. Where there was a belief in Hebrew culture that if the animal saw spotted rods while he ate, the animals that would come out as offspring would be spotted. Now, of course, this is sheer bunk. This is just a wives' tale. But this explains that strange story there in the book of Genesis. For years, I wondered what it meant. There were Hebrews who believed this. Yeah, put spotted rods in front of them, and the animals will come out spotted. So, ta-da! All of a sudden, there's an explosion of livestock that are spotted. And, of course, Laban's wondering, what did I do wrong? You know, he's thinking, you know, he hadn't had much spotted cattle up to that point, and suddenly he has spotted cattle. Does this mean now that we should, that this works, like this witchcraft kind of thing works? No, Yahweh already made up his mind he was going to bless Jacob. Jacob and his wife could have gotten in front of the animals and danced the twist. It still would have come out spotted animals, because Yahweh knew, okay, spotted animals is how I'm going to bless Jacob. Had nothing to do with those rods. But the mere fact that they use those rods, you know, it's in Hebrew culture. That doesn't make it right. By the way, this is something I'm really wound up with doctrinally. Over the years, you know, guys, some of you who are in my generation, you know what it's like. You see people compromise, things go well, and they think they were blessed because they compromised. I didn't do anything wrong. I was blessed. And it's really hard to untangle that stuff. Hebrew culture can be used to explain something unusual in the Bible, but it is an unreliable tool for proving doctrine. Okay, literary applications. Word plays and catchy phrases in the Hebrew text. I kind of love this stuff. This is the fun and game stuff. In Jeremiah 1, verse 11 to 12, it says, moreover, the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Jeremiah, what seest thou? And I said, I see a rod of an almond tree. Then said Yahweh unto me, thou hast well seen, for I will hasten my word to perform it. Now I've underlined the word almond and the word hasten. Now a Hebrew reading this are hearing this immediately catches the fact that the word for almond tree and hasten are almost identical in Hebrew. It's based on the vowel points in Strong's Concordance anyway. The almond tree is shokad, but the word for hasten is shakad. Otherwise, the almond tree has absolutely no application to Yahweh being diligent about what he's doing. But here, it's all based on a wordplay. Yeah, what do you see, Jeremiah? He says, I see a hurry-up tree. That's right, I'm going to hurry up and make sure my word is fulfilled. That's kind of like what it sounded to him. Wordplays and catchy phrases in the Hebrew text. This stuff really delights us when we see it because it's evidence of Yahweh's glory. We've all heard this phrase from the Psalms, pray for the peace of Jerusalem, they shall prosper that love thee. The first three words, now remember, you have to read right to left. The first three words are Shalu Shalom Yerushalayim. It's such a lovely sound. I know some Messianic Jews who made a song out of it. Shalu Shalom Yerushalayim, Shalu Shalom Yerushalayim. Wouldn't it be wonderful to know Hebrew and catch this stuff wherever it was? Not everybody has time for Hebrew, but it's nice when it comes up. I see Brother Russ over there is kind of puzzled. I'm sorry. No, I did verify that, but what I just showed you guys. Here's another wordplay I really love. And now we're transitioning to the Hebrew Matthew. Everybody knows Hebrew wrote in Matthew first. Everybody knows that. It was such a well-established fact. Yet there are scholars today who say, no, Mark wrote his first. No, Mark did it first. And they say this stuff as if to overthrow everything that's been so well-established. There are two Hebrew Matthew traditions out there. I'll be saying more about them in a moment. But one of them is called the Shem Tob Hebrew Matthew. There's almost two dozen manuscripts now discovered around the world, and they reside primarily in Jewish libraries. They're used as rebuttal tools. What they do is they read that to understand how Christians think, and then they go out into the world and enter into debate with Christians. Now, this was in the Dark Ages, so these are sort of leftover manuscripts from that time. In the Beatitudes, Yahshua says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of Yahweh. Verse 10, blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now the Hebrew Matthew and Shem Tov reads, blessed are they who pursue peace, and blessed are they who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. So it doesn't say peacemaker, it says pursue peace, like you're running after it. Take a closer look at the Hebrew word there. This is a word you'll find in your Strong's Concordance, so anybody could look it up. The root is three letters, Resh, Dalet, Pe, Radaf. Altogether, it sounds like Radaf. And it means to run after. I've underlined some of the key words there. Hunt or persecute. So the Shem Tov says, blessed are they who pursue peace. And I've tried to indicate the Hebrew letters there. I didn't have time to do the correct drop-in of the Hebrew letters. So I try to transliterate it with Rudfi. But I underlined the key letters, R-D-F there, Rudfi. Blessed are they who pursue, Rudfi, peace. Then it says, blessed are they who are persecuted, Hagridfim. Hagridfim, there it is, Hagridfim. And I've underlined the root word letters, RDF, there. Now, to the Hebrew, when he hears this, it's a beautiful wordplay. Here's what it sounds like. I know I put a rendering at the bottom of the panel there, but here's how it sounds like in the Hebrew when they heard this. Blessed are they who chase after peace, for they shall be called the children of Elohim. Blessed are those who are chased after for righteousness' sake. Just one of many delicious things in the Hebrew Matthew. Word plays and catchy phrases in the Hebrew text. I have found no risks in this kind of research, but one must be careful again not to extrapolate doctrine from it. The word plays and evident poetry are meant to be attention getters. I also think they're a stamp of divine authority. When this was published in the mid-80s, late 1980s, I got one right away. The Gospel of Matthew According to a Primitive Hebrew Text by Dr. George Howard of the University of Georgia, Macon, Georgia. I had the pleasure of talking with him by telephone and corresponding with him, one cycle of correspondence. Because here, if you look at the back, the Hebrew letters are very hard to make out. He sent me a chart to figure this out for myself. I don't have time to do this. I also have a photostat of one of those many manuscripts around the world. It's from the British Library. It's a roll. I left it at home. And I don't have time to do that. I have to rely on scholars to publish compilations of it. But Dr. George Howard is kind of an ally of ours. He's the one who published that article about how the Holy Name was likely in the Greek text. And so he's kind of our buddy there. Let's see, the other Hebrew Matthew is called the Deutelet text. And I'll tell you a little bit about these texts. They were used by Jews to study Christianity so that they were forced to go into public debate with Catholics. They could have some ammunition. And they always lost the debate. The whole idea was to humiliate them. But the texts are different. The Shem Tov and the Deutelet texts are different. Now, what I have here in this blue notebook is a photostat from a translation made by Hugh Schoenfield back when he was a dedicated Messianic Jew. He went crazy. I'm not even going to talk about the things he wrote when he went crazy. But I made a photostat. I actually ordered the microfilm and then made a photostat of the microfilm. And this here, you guys can look at this stuff later if you want, but this is a photostat of the Deutelet text. Now this I can read because it's the Babylonian style Hebrew letters, and I've been able to look up stuff to my own satisfaction there without relying on other translators. Like everything else, you have to be careful though. The Hebrew roots approach to the faith allows us to solve not a problem in the Greek text. But Brother Michael's rules for exceptional texts is as follows. Do not use an unusual text to overthrow the main text. Use it only to clarify a difficulty in your main text. Please, I appeal to you to think about this. Suppose we found the original Hebrew and Aramaic New Testament documents. And they were verified, they were provenanced, high degree of scholarly confirmation. You know, friends, somebody would still have to translate it for me. You know? So I can't translate that stuff. I don't have time to go that deep. We're called to good works, we're called to holiness, we're called to prayer, you know. Now, some people have the intellectual capacity to go real deep into that stuff. I don't mind standing on their shoulders. But to tell you the truth, the Greek text is actually in pretty good shape. And the evidence is very strong that Yahweh's name was even in the Greek texts. Not only that, if somebody was to translate a Hebrew original, they'd probably use the Greek text as a guide. Not 100%, but you know, to inform them as they step through it. When other people cite an unusual text, check the original to see if they did it properly. Now, for the Deutelet text, there's only one in existence. Actually, this is the text compiled by some Christian scholar named Jean Deutelet during the Renaissance. But there are many copies of this George Howard thing. This one I'm holding up now is from the library at Holt Summit. It's a second edition of the one I bought in the 1980s. But Deutelet got his text from a manuscript in the library in Paris, the Bibliothèque Library in Paris. I don't think anybody has bothered to get a copy of that thing. I wonder if it survived the war. More on literary applications. Where's the name? Where's the name? Can we use these Hebrew Matthews to tell us where the name is? Both the Shem Tov and Deuteronomy Hebrew Matthew texts were in the possession of Jews through the ages. So they're kind of like hostile keepers. You know, it's not their book. They're just preserving it so they can study their opponent's logic. But it turns out both manuscripts tell us where the holy name occurs. The Shem Tov text has a single he for Hashem, the name. And the Deuteronomy text, where the name appears, there's three yods. And I can show you these later if you want to see them at the lunch tables or whatever. In most places, these two manuscripts agree where the name should appear. Most surprisingly, this is important. In these Hebrew Matthews, the holy name appears in fresh New Testament material. Now, you would expect to see the holy name when they're quoting from the Old Testament. If the holy name's there, you'd expect to see it there. But when that Jewish scribe who had these two manuscripts, it was two different places in Europe, but when that scribe found the holy name in a quote from, let's say, the prophets, I could see him putting a little abbreviation in there, three yods or a hey or something. But his insides must have turned to water when he came to new stuff, New Testament material that wasn't quotes from the old, and there was the holy name there. And for him to render that with the same code that he used for Old Testament references, that is decisive proof that Matthew put the holy name in his book. You just can't get around that. And it's from two different witnesses. These are two different manuscript traditions. Look at this thing taking off on me, sorry. When I discovered that these manuscripts gave us such clear evidence of the holy name, I was absolutely electrified. Here's the rundown. I did this tally myself. I don't think anybody else has ever published this. I know it's hard to read, but I'm just trying to give you evidence. On the left-hand side, you have a column labeled verse. Those are the verses where the holy name of Yahweh appears in the Hebrew Matthew. In the Shem Tov manuscript, I indicate a Y anywhere he put it there. If it isn't there, I just say no or put another kind of note. In the Deuteronomy text, it doesn't appear as often. And what noteworthy in chapter 2, verse 15, the holy name is fully spelled out in the Deuteronomy text. I don't know how that happened. I don't see why a Jewish scribe would do that. Maybe he was not paying attention. But if a Jewish scribe fully spelled it out, that tells me it was fully spelled out in Matthew's original. So they agree in most places, these two texts. I do not use these manuscripts to change things. I use them to throw light on what I already have. I'm trying to be cautious. Let's remember these manuscripts were in the possession of those who don't believe in Yahshua. Let's go with one more literary application. The ending of Matthew, a very controversial ending. The Great Commission. Go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. Amen. The problem is this Trinitarian thing, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. We don't have any record of anyone doing that. They always baptize into Yahshua's name. Furthermore, hardcore Trinitarians from that era failed to quote this verse as evidence of the Trinity. Now, there's a larger study available on the internet as to why we believe that the wording there was an ecclesiastical change. I like Elder Allen's choice of words on this. It was an ecclesiastical change. I do not like tampering with any manuscript, but I believe in this case it's justified. What do you know? The Shem Tov Hebrew Matthew has a very different ending. He just says, go and teach them to carry out all things which I have commanded you forever. And Dr. George Howard, he jumped on that. He said, that is a ancient, authentic, original rendering. So you see, this Hebrew roots approach causes me to reach for a Hebrew Matthew, and it allows me, it enables me to resolve some knotty problems in the Greek. Oh, here's another one. Clarify the Pharisees' role in casting out demons. Matthew 12:26. Yahshua is talking to the Pharisees. And if Satan cast out Satan, he is divided against himself. How shall then his kingdom stand? And if I by Beelzebub cast out devils, by whom do your children cast them out? Therefore, they shall be your judges. Well, the Shem Tov says, and if I by Beelzebub cast out devils, why do your sons not cast them out? That puts a whole new perspective on that. I think that's a preferred reading. Now, you can find similar things in the Aramaic Peshitta, New Testament, the Syriac, similar things where you take a close look, and it helps smooth over stuff that the Greek is either bumpy or hard to understand. Here's one for you. I don't think I included this. No. Matthew's genealogies are clearly meant to be three groups of 14 apiece. But you do the count and you find there's a name missing. But that extra name shows up in the Deuteronomy text. And when you look at the Hebrew, it looks just like the name next to it. It's Abiyur, close, right next to the name Abiud. And because the Resh and the Dalet look alike, some Greek guy got sloppy and skipped over it. Haven't you guys ever copied things from one page to another and you skip stuff because maybe it looked the same, or you jumped a paragraph because it started with the same word? But these texts have a way of helping us resolve these things, and they renew our faith in the record. My concern, though, with alternate manuscripts is that they're often in the possession of hostile owners, so the content is not well provenanced. There was nobody really looking over it. So I would never grab this and say, yep, this John Deuteronomy text, this is the truth. I would never say that. I wouldn't say that about the Shem Tov or the Aramaic or any other. Now, the approach I take is called eclecticism, where you reach for every resource you can, and you try to resolve what makes the best sense based on other scriptures that are well established. I won't get into the details, but a lot of today's researchers seem to have a flair for novelty rather than rigor. While it is tempting to grasp one novel manuscript and claim it has, quote, the truth, it may contain things which are unexpected and troubling. Let's talk about genealogical applications. This is just an example of the leadership of the Ephraimites. One of the most enjoyable ways to study the Bible is to chase a word through the Bible. Pick a word that you'd like to know more about in the liturgy and just look it up everywhere. The sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, received the birthright. Joshua was an Ephraimite. And if you chase the word Ephraim and Ephraimite through the Bible, you'll find that there was evidence of leadership there. Rehoboam was the first king of the northern tribes. He was an Ephraimite. Shiloh was the original resting place of the ark. This was an Ephraim. By opening up your Hebrew book and looking these things up, you say, hey, there's a trend here. There's a pattern here. There's also evidence of racism in there, or some kind of inter-tribal hostility with Ephraim, maybe resentment over their leadership position. The identity of prophetic figures are often found in genealogies and thus hold the key to prophetic passages. In Ezekiel 38:2, I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal, and prophesy against them. Well, in Genesis 2, most of these guys are mentioned. The sons of Japheth, Gomer and Magog, Madai and Javan, and Tubal and Meshech. There's no way you're going to study Ezekiel 38 prophecy without first looking up Genesis 10, verse 2. And the related verses, make sure you have the identity of these guys in hand. Now, at the time this was brought to my attention, I was studying Russian in college. It did not escape my notice. The word for chief prince there in Ezekiel 38:2. Well, that's the Hebrew word rosh. Well, that sounds like Russia to me. Meshech sounds like Moscow to me. Tobol, do you know there's a major town in Russia called Tobolsk? And it's the official capital of Siberia. Does Magog look like Mongolia to you? Maybe, maybe. You know, remember, I'm not trying to establish doctrine here. I'm just saying these things come to you as you're reading this with an eye toward the Hebrew words there. Those were theories popular back during the Cold War. I don't hear a whole lot of people talk about that association with possibly with Russia anymore. I'm hearing other end-time prophecy theories these days. But if you're going to study Ezekiel 38, you better look up Genesis 10 while you're at it. But there's a risk in studying genealogical applications. Genealogical novelties leading to identity theories, which in turn become doctrines and govern and shape the churches. There are churches that have gone into a death spiral, wrapping themselves in an identity doctrine. They just hit a brick wall and they don't go anywhere. Often creating resentments within the churches because you don't have quite the right identity or quite the right race. There are some people out there who believe they're Ephraimite, and maybe they are, but you know, Ephraim was 50% Egyptian because Joseph's wife was an Egyptian. So that means Ephraim was 50% African. Okay, you can't get around that. It's kind of thought-provoking as to wonder, well, what did the Ephraimites really look like? They had a slightly different dialect of Hebrew because of that incident in the book of Judges. They couldn't say the word shibboleth and they got killed for it. We don't want to be like that. We don't want to kill people or cut them off because of a genealogical origin. In fact, I should have put it in here. The Apostle Paul warns us not to get caught up in genealogies. That can be really dangerous stuff. As long as it throws light on the scriptures and helps us understand the whole thing as a unit, that's great. But I know with certainty everybody here would resent a identity doctrine that caused one man to look down upon another. Who were the Hebrews? They're the offspring of Eber. Now, that's Strong's number 5680. And that first letter is the Ayin, and I'm purposely pronouncing it that way. Later in history, the Ayin developed a ah sound, but originally it was more like Louis Armstrong gargling. Okay, hello, Dolly. You've heard of Sodom and Gomorrah. Gomorrah starts with the letter Ayin. Now, at the end of Yahshua's name, you pronounce it like a ah, but there were devout Greek-speaking Jews in Alexandria, Egypt. They translated the Hebrew Bible to Greek. They loved Yahweh's name. We have two historical witnesses telling us that they rendered Yahweh's name in Hebrew letters in the Greek text. In fact, one of those historical references says they put Yahweh's name in gold paint. They loved Yahweh's name. There's no question about that. But they rendered Gomorrah with the Greek gamma in the front. Gomorrah. But it was really originally Amora. Amora. So what did the word Eber sound like? Something like Eber. By the way, it took me a long time to learn how to make that sound. Who were the Hebrews? It's exact same Hebrew letters. In this vowel pointing here for Strong's 5674, it's Abar. And I'll probably pronounce it that way going forward, Abar. A primitive root to cross over, that's the fundamental meaning. And then you find out all these secondary meanings have something to do with that. This is one of these cases where the root meaning really does carry a lot of theological punch. This is the stuff I want to focus on to cross over. We're going to dwell on that a bit. In Genesis 10:21, unto Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth the elder, even to him were children born. Okay, Eber is Semitic. That's what that verse is telling me. Genesis 10:22, the children of Shem, and it's listed there, Elam and Asher and Arphaxad and Lud and Aram. Aram would be where the Aramaic language came from. And the children of Aram, Uz and Hul and Gether and Mash. Then to verse 24, Arphaxad begat Salah and Salah begat Eber. So you get the Hebrew language and the Aramaic language from this guy named Shem, one of the sons of Noah. Let's take a closer look at the offspring of Eber. I know these letters are kind of small, but I underlined and emboldened some of the key characters. Now, in this part of Genesis, he's not trying to document everybody who was ever born. But you know, Yahweh's purpose in the book of Genesis is to show that trajectory going from the Garden of Eden through Noah down to Abraham. I was really rejoiceful yesterday at the presentation by Terry O'Neill. I told him later, that is a sermon I've always wanted to give, to show Yahweh's plan of salvation play out for mankind, starting in general and focusing down tighter and tighter into specific players in the Israelite race. The objective here is to show the sequence of names getting to Abraham down there in Genesis 11:26. But these guys had kids, their kids had kids. I mean, there was this vast numbers of people that came out of Eber, but nobody ever talks about them. Not because we're morally deficient or dumbbells, it's just that we've been busy looking at other things. But these people had to go somewhere. Their kids had to go somewhere. The Hebrews flooded the Middle East. I'm going to list to you some Hebrews who are known to be there, based in the Bible. The Ishmaelites, the Edomites, the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Midianites. This is just a sampling. Then there are other Hebrew-speaking peoples. There was the Ugaritic settlement that we discovered in the western part of the Holy Land. Phoenician. Phoenician's a nice general term they use for all those people who spoke a language similar to Hebrew. It's obvious to anybody who looked, anybody who's a man of faith or a woman of faith, and they look what the scholars are saying, it's obvious they're scared to death to say that they spoke Hebrew. But everybody knows it's a Hebrew language. It just bugs me. Those Phoenicians, those people that the scholars call the Phoenicians, these are Hebrews. They spoke Hebrew. Their alphabet's Hebrew, their letters are Hebrew, their words are Hebrew. Now, in Deuteronomy 7, Yahweh requires the seven Canaanite nations to be destroyed. When Yahweh the Elohim shall bring thee into the land whither thou goest to possess it, and have cast out many nations before thee, the Hittites, and the Girgashites, and the Amorites, and the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than thou. And when Yahweh the Elohim shall deliver them before thee, thou shalt smite them and utterly destroy them. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them. Why? Often the ancient Israelites are accused of genocide by people who don't know better. These are the only ones they had to eliminate. When you combine what we know from the scriptures and archaeological finds, these seven nations were the Nazis of their era. You name it, they did it. They were culturally refined, but they were indescribably cruel. Name some filthy, unspeakable thing that I won't even dare mention in mixed company. They did it. Unbelievable stuff. And I could see where Elohim looked down and said, there's only one way to deal with this, and just cut it all off. And it was confined to just those seven nations. But the rest of the nations in the conquest of the Holy Land got better treatment. Also in Deuteronomy, jump down to the middle, please. Deuteronomy 10-12, when thou comest nigh unto a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it. And it shall be, if it make thee answer of peace and open unto thee, then it shall be that all the people that is found therein shall be tributaries unto thee, and they shall serve thee. And if it will make no peace with thee, but will make war against thee, then thou shalt besiege it. So basically, all they had to do is pay taxes. Pay taxes to a government that was guaranteed supernatural protection. Why were all the other cities in the Holy Land given this special treatment? It goes back to a prophecy uttered over Jacob. In Genesis 27:29, Isaac is blessing Jacob, and he says, let people serve thee, and nations bow down to thee. Then he says, be ruler over thy brethren, and let thy mother's sons bow down to thee. Cursed be everyone that curses thee, and blessed be he that blesses thee. I want to focus on that command, be ruler over thy brethren. Remember, I told you the Almighty's name is structured with an ancient verb to be, hawa, a rare and ancient verb to be. It only occurs 6 times that I can find in the Old Testament. This is one of those 6 times. When he says, be ruler over thy brethren, it's that real ancient verb to be. It has that classical ancient sound to it in the ears of the Hebrew. So he was telling him this with authority. So I look up the word brethren, and Strong says it's used in the widest sense of literal relationship and metaphorical affinity or resemblance. He's telling Jacob to be ruler over all the Hebrews. That's why all those other nations were given better treatment there. They were fellow Hebrews. Jacob was prophesied to rule over all the Hebrews of the Middle East. If you recall, the boundaries promised to Abraham encompassed a wide swath of land. Certainly that would have included all those Phoenicians that the scholars refute us to call Hebrews. The mistake we make is assuming Hebrew equals Israelite, and all Israelites are Hebrew, but not all Hebrews are Israelites. But the Canaanites, a corrupting influence, they had to be destroyed. The fundamental meaning of the word Eber, meaning to cross over, is important as we thunder to the finish line here. I'm going to invest a lot of energy in this part of it. Cross over. They crossed over into the Holy Land in most ancient times, bunches of them. Where did everybody come from? This should be obvious. Where did everybody come from? Everybody came from Babylon. Remember, they were all gathered around that tower. Well, we're going to make a name for ourselves. And then Yahweh had to scatter them out. Everybody originates from the Chaldees, Babylon. Abraham was one of the last to cross over from the Ur of the Chaldees. Abraham passed through the Promised Land. He spoke freely with all who were there. Whatever brand of Hebrew or Aramaic was spoken by Abraham's clan, Israel as a nation had 400 years in Egypt to develop their own unique dialect, which became Biblical Hebrew. It's just one of many dialects of Hebrew. Even then, it appears that northern Israel, under the influence of Ephraim and Manasseh, the leadership tribes, had their own dialect of Hebrew, a northern variety. I'm not saying it was unintelligible. I'm just saying there were slight differences. So let's have some fun with this. True Hebrew roots is buying blankets, cookware, and table accessories with lots of Hebrew letters on them. Is that Hebrew roots? Is it learning cool things about the Hebrew scriptures and then showing it off in conversation? Maybe some of you remember 15, 20 years ago, a lot of us discovered that the prophet Elijah sometimes has his name spelled Eliyahu. And all of a sudden, people were calling him Eliyahu. And I thought, wasn't that strange? When it's transcribed into the Greek language, they drop the wow there. I mean, is it really that important? I really got the impression some people were calling Elijah Eliyahu to tip me off that they knew about this. You know, it's just an impression I got. Because he's also called plenty of times Eliyah in the scriptures. But is that going Hebrew? We're going to go Hebrew roots. We're going to get real authentic now to show off knowledge. Is that what this is all about? How about gleaning other people's research on the Hebrew roots of the faith? Starting a web page from your mother's basement as an income generating scheme. Is that Hebrew roots? Let's face it, there's a lot of interesting information here, and some people are willing to pay for it. There's one guy in the Hebrew Roots movement who's really distinguished himself. He doesn't need my approval, but his name is Brad Scott, and he once broke down, and he posted up a message on the internet, because he does a lot of this Hebrew research stuff, and he concluded he was going in the wrong direction. He says, you know, there's hungry people out there that got to be fed. There's people with needs. We should be teaching people how to not sin. You can go into a real death spiral picking away at fine points of the Hebrew roots of the faith. As you'll see shortly, that's not the Hebrew roots of the faith. How about doing everything Jewish style? Kippahs, prayer shawls, eating bagels and lox. Is that going into the Hebrew roots of the faith? Well, of course not. When we do a thoughtful review of Jacob's reconciliation with Esau, it shows the true Hebrew roots of the faith. And this is what I beg you to take and weave into your soul. I want you to think seriously about Jacob's experience. Observant Bible students will tell you that Jacob experienced his conversion the night he wrestled with the angel. It's the events prior to that and the events after that which really lock it in. And I'd like to see if you guys can identify yourself with Jacob. Have you ever been at odds with somebody and you were afraid to face them? You didn't want to make eye contact with them. Remember, Jacob had swindled the blessing from his brother Esau. And then he stole the birthright from, I'm sorry, he stole the birthright and he, how did it go? He stole one and he swindled the other. I mean, he just pretty much did a number on his brother Esau, got everything. The reason Yahweh loved Jacob is because he reverenced the blessing, not because he was a crook. His name Jacob meant supplanter. There came a point where he had to meet Esau. Going to meet his brother Esau, whom he defrauded several years prior, Jacob learns that his brother is approaching with 400 men. A messenger says, it's 400 guys with your brother. So Jacob figures he's going to get killed. He's going to get slaughtered. Anticipating a vengeful slaughter, Jacob divides his family entourage to minimize the casualties. He spreads them out, divides them into groups, and he prays for deliverance. He wrestles with an angel overnight, and he's crippled by the angel, while his name is changed to Israel, which means ruler with Elohim. Still, he sends many gifts ahead for Esau to receive first. He gets cattle and riches, and he sends them ahead. Tell him it's a gift. Tell him it's a gift. But when he meets Esau, finally connects with him, I don't know how they arranged the meeting, but he finally gets there. He bows down to the ground 7 times on the way to meet him. But what really cinched it for him to make peace with this brother he had defrauded was from a distance Esau did not see a man dressed in fine clothes and being carried on a pallet or anything. What he saw was his brother hobbling from that broken thigh joint, whatever that was. His brother was hobbling along. I got to believe Esau's heart turned to water. He said, my gosh, that poor suffering man. And then he's bowing to the ground 7 times. So he's hobbling along for a while, and he bows to the ground. Esau's heart must have gushed. We're going to take a closer look at this story. We're going to be wrapping up with this. The word Eber appears in this passage 10 times. It's used in reference to him crossing over the Jordan, crossing at Jabbok. Now that I've told you what to watch for, it might go easier. I'm going to try to read fast. But I ask you to really wrap your heart around this. This is the Hebrew roots of the faith. Speaking of hobbling. We love you, sister. Okay. Oh, let's see, Genesis around 32. You've been all very patient with me. I'm going to start at chapter 32. There's some material in chapter 31 I think we can skip. I'm going to hope to point out places where the word Eber is used. There's a few places in the preparatory material in chapter 31, but going to chapter 32, verse 1 in Genesis. And Jacob went on his way, and the angels of Elohim met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is Elohim's host." And he called the name of that place Mahanaim. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, into the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, "Thus shall you speak unto my master Esau, thy servant Jacob saith thus, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now. I have oxen and asses, flocks and manservants and women servants, and I have sent to tell my master that I may find grace in thy sight." And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to thy brother Esau, and he also cometh to meet thee, and 400 men with him." You know, big guys like Paul and Mel, okay? 400 big guys. Mm-hmm. Verse 7, Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that was with him and the flocks and herds and the camels into two bands. And he said, "If Esau came to the one company and smite it, then the other company which is left shall escape," trying to minimize his losses. And Jacob said, "O Elohim of my father Abraham and Elohim of my father Isaac, Yahweh which said unto me, return unto thy country and to thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee. I am not worthy of the least of thy mercies of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant, for with my staff I passed over Eber, I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two bands. Deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he will come and smite me and the mother with the children. And thou said, I will surely do thee good and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude." And he lodged there that same night and took of that which came to his hand a present for Esau his brother, 200 she-goats and 20 he-goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milk camels with their goat colts, 40 kine and 10 bulls, 20 she-asses and 10 foals. And he delivered them into the hand of his servants, every drove by themselves, and said unto his servants, "Pass over Eber before me and put a space betwixt drove and drove." So it's like a phalanx of these animals with delivery men, with wave after wave of gifts, trying to cool his brother down. And he commanded the foremost, saying, "When Esau my brother meets thee and asks thee, saying, whose art thou, and whither goest thou, and whose art these before thee, then thou shalt say, they be thy servant Jacob's. It's a present sent unto my master Esau, and behold, also he is behind us." So there's a wave of gifts. And he says, Jacob's on his way. Instead of Jacob, it's another wave of gifts and another wave of gifts. So this guy, you can be sure Jacob is really scared. And so commanded he the second and the third and all that followed the droves, "On this manner shall you speak unto Esau when you find him. And say ye moreover, behold, thy servant Jacob is behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goeth before me, and afterward I will see his face. Peradventure he will accept of me. So went the present over before him," the word Eber's in there again, "and himself lodged that night in the company. And he rose up that night and took his two wives and his two women servants and his 11 sons and Eber over the ford Jabbok. And he took them and sent them over the brook and sent over that he had," Eber. "Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until breaking of day." This is the famous story where he wrestled with an angel. "And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, let me go, for the day breaketh. And he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me." This is where Jacob's quality was that Yahweh treasured in him. "I'm not going to let you go until you bless me." He treasured the blessing. He wanted the blessing. And he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Supplanter, Jacob." Jacob, supplanter. And he said, "Thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince hast thou power with Elohim and with men, and hast prevailed." And Jacob asked him and said, "Tell me, I pray thee, thy name." And he said, "Wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name?" And he blessed him there. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, "For I have seen Elohim face to face, and my life is preserved." And as he passed over Peniel, the sun rose upon him, and he halted upon his thigh. See, he was limping on his thigh. a pathetic sight. Therefore the children of Israel eat not upon the sinew which shrank, which is upon the hollow of the thigh, unto this day, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh and the sinew of the shank. Chapter 33, and Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau came, and with him 400 men. And he divided the children unto Leah and unto Rachel, and he put the handmaids and their children foremost, and Leah and her children after, Rachel and Joseph hindermost. And he passed over Eber before them and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near his brother. And Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. You think Jacob wasn't humbled and humiliated by this whole thing? That's the Hebrew roots of the faith. You think of all those things that happened there. You think upon the way the word Eber is embedded and drenched in that passage. So here's my side of the story. Hebrew roots of the faith implies pilgrimage. We're just passing over this land on the way to a place greater. Hebrew roots means there's blessings for others as we pass through. I absolutely love Psalm 84. How amiable are the tabernacles, O Yahweh of hosts. My soul longeth, yea, even fainteth for the courts of Yahweh, my heart, and my flesh cries out for the living Elohim. Isn't that where your heart is? Wherever you're at, you're never close enough to him. Yea, the sparrow hath found a house, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may lay her young, even thine altars. O Yahweh of hosts, my King and my Elohim, blessed are they that dwell in thy house. They will still be praising thee. Blessed is the man whose strength is in thee and whose heart are the ways of them. Note verse 6. Passing through the valley of Baca, make it a well. The rain also filleth the pools. They go from strength to strength. Every one of them in Zion appears before Elohim. Hebrew roots means you're on a journey. And everywhere you go, you make it better. Have you guys noticed that this facility here is a little dirty? I'd like to see it cleaner when we leave than when we got here. That's Hebrew roots. Timely upgrades. This is what Hebrew roots means to me. Timely upgrades. It transitions from where you are now to a better place at each step. I guess modern folks would call it continuing improvement. That's real Hebrew roots. In Isaiah 60, it says, the sons also of them that afflicted thee shall come bending unto thee, and all they that despise thee shall bow themselves down at the soles of thy feet. They shall call thee the city of Yahweh, the Zion of the Holy One of Israel. Okay, this is talking about Jerusalem. Zion is one of the names for that hill. Verse 15, whereas thou hast been forsaken and hated, so that no man went through thee, Auber, I will make thee an eternal excellency, a joy of many generations. Thou shalt also suck the milk of the Gentiles, and shall suck the breast of kings, and shall know that I, Yahweh, am thy Savior and thy Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob. Note verse 17. For brass I will bring gold, for iron I will bring silver, for wood brass, for stones iron. I will also make thy officers peace and thine exactors righteousness. Remember that song? For your iron I'll give you silver, for your brass I'll give you gold. That's where this comes from. Everybody is a candidate for an upgrade. Everybody is a candidate for improvement. Everybody's worthy of redemption. Everybody can go forward. Everybody can step up. That's real Eber roots. Here we are identified with Zion in Hebrews 12:22. But you are come unto Mount Zion and unto the city of the living Elohim, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels. I don't have to read the rest, but I think you get the point. A thoughtful review of Jacob's reconciliation with Esau shows the true Hebrew roots of the faith. One important way to make changes, upgrades, is by listening. Now, either you're going to be hearing something inside, or you're going to hear something in your ears. Now, it could be from behind the microphone, or it could be a friend coming to you, or it could be conversations around the campfire. For whosoever shall call upon the name of Yahweh shall be saved. Romans 10:13. How then shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how shall they believe in him whom they have not heard? Hebrew roots means listening. Because you're always going to be changing. You're always going to be improving. How should they hear without a preacher? And how should they preach except they be sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of them that preach the good news of peace and bringing glad tidings of good things. Hebrew roots of the faith then means creating change by communicating. Malachi 3:16. Then they that feared Yahweh spoke often one to another, and Yahweh hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared Yahweh and that thought upon his name. I've been a single man all my life, and one thing that always irks me in a married couple was when one of them withdraws their spirit from the other. And I've seen both genders do this. It's an absolutely terrifying thing when a man withdraws his spirit from his wife, refuses to talk, refuses to communicate. And long before sin sets into a marriage on the rocks, somebody withdrew their spirit from the other. Malachi 3:16 doesn't make provision for that. I've seen men do it. I've read about men doing it. Drives their wives nuts. But look, there's going to be days when the men, they're kind of burned out and they need a little time to rest before they can talk. I'm not referring to that. I'm talking about a systematic, consistent shutting down of communication with your wives. And girls, there's times when you do this. Cold shoulder, the snub, you know. Is something wrong? No, nothing's wrong. You know, we know about that. Malachi 3:16 makes no provision for that. By the way, now we know more why Paul put such an emphasis on our relationships. Of course we want to be nice to each other. We want to be available to each other. But from the standpoint of Hebrew roots, crossing over into the promised land, crossing over into Zion, moving forward, being nice to each other facilitates the encouragement and the changes we need to keep moving. Yeah, we create change by communicating, but here's the challenge. To be a blessing and help to those who are just starting out and at the same time relate to those who are farther along. That's a real challenge. You're going to be tempted to hang around people of like mind. You're going to be tempted to hang around with people who talk about what you want to talk about. You're going to be tempted to hang around with people who see things the way you do. Well, I was taught early in the feast experiences, way back in the 1980s, everybody's the hospitality chairman. We should all make ourselves available to each other, even to those who are just starting out. And we got to be careful what we communicate to them. You know, you can overwhelm people and just crush them with stuff that not only is going to go over their head, but actually may offend them, may horrify them. It turns out it wasn't nothing anyway. We should be real careful what we tell to newcomers because there's a long trip ahead. Yeah, who can be all things to all men, all women to all men, all things to all men and all women? Who can do that to relate to the newcomer as well as to those who are farther along? Seeing that we're all on this journey together, it strikes me as absolutely imperative. Do you think Yahshua had a hard time relating to newcomers? Do you think Yahshua says, "Oh, these newcomers, I don't want to hang around with them. I'm going to go hang around with the Pharisees and argue with them for a while." No, that's not what happened. Closing remarks. You've been so patient with me. It gives me such a lift to see your faces light up as I share this stuff with you. True Hebrew crossover roots is based on understanding the journey and the transforming process of this walk. This is exactly what Jacob experienced during his conversion experience that night that he wrestled with the angel. It is characterized by humility, action, communication, and alertness to promptings to move forward. With this kind of Hebrew roots mentality, Jacob's travels, Abraham's travels, the pilgrimages of the ancients, and your own walk all become the very same thing. Mighty Shalom. Yahweh bless you.